Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Brad Sylvain, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank the committee, and I want to thank Zach, his beautiful wife, and his daughter, just for, you know, extending a hand to me and being kind, having breakfast with me this morning, and this committee for putting on what a remarkable conference it has been so far. I mean, everything I have attended has been almost perfect, and so if you can imagine the pressure I'm feeling right now to not mess this thing up, you know. Everything I've, you know, from the step series to the talk last night, I mean, it has been miraculous to hear the message Alcoholics Anonymous conveyed to the speakers here tonight. So just what a remarkable job from that committee. So let's give them a round of applause. My home group is the 103 group, Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a big book step study group. It meets Wednesday nights at 7 p.m. in West Palm Beach, Florida. If you're ever in the area, I hope you reach out to us. Read the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, a paragraph at a time, and we share on those paragraphs. And sometimes we'll spend a whole, you know, hour reading a paragraph, and sometimes we'll get through a couple pages. But, you know, we're just passionate about the literature and the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor's name is Tommy M., and as a result of doing the steps, I have recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body that alcoholism took me to. And so I'm going to do my best to share in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. You know, and I hope more than anything else that if there's someone in here who's new to Alcoholics Anonymous, that something I say encourages you to get right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's this triangle, you'll see it everywhere, and there's unity, service, and recovery. And I hope that, you know, you give this thing a shot of getting right in the middle by doing the steps, having a sponsor, being active in a group, having a fellowship, and giving back to this program that has saved my life. Before, you know, every time before I talk, I get this restless, you know, feeling. I'm walking around pacing. If you were here early, you've seen it, you know, and I look at all these pictures, and I'm looking at Dr. Bob, and I'm looking at Bill W., and I'm thinking about how these men and these women have had such a significant impact on my life, and they've never even met me. They changed the course and the trajectory of my life, right? And we are people who would not mix. See, I was restless, irritable, and discontent before I ever picked up alcohol. As early as I can remember, I had this internal discomfort. And I have looked for things to escape that internal discomfort from the beginning of my lifetime. There's a couple things that have really been a catalyst for what I've learned today to be my spiritual malady. And see, I come from a non-alcoholic home. I come from a beautiful, loving family. My parents are married 40 years. I've had everything you would ever want in life. And as a child, I still felt not a part of. See, my father is African-American. My mother is Irish Catholic. Alcoholism runs rampant on one side of my family. You guys guess what's... what side it is. But I'm telling you, this thought pattern, you know, I loved Beth talking last night about the committee upstairs. At 6 years old, I can remember the committee going about how I didn't fit in because I had biracial parents. How everybody in my neighborhood was either black or white, and I was different. You know what I mean? What are you, Brad? I'm different. Little did I know, most of you have always anticipated I was Hispanic, and if I just learned Spanish, I probably would have gone far in my life and not had any of those insecurities I had as a kid. You know. Additionally, along with that, in first grade, my teacher told my parents that I was not keeping up in class. And so they put me in a special school for learning disabled children. And I could tell you how selfish and self-centered I was. And in the first grade, I imagined that every single kid at my last school knew I wasn't smart enough. No one told them that. No one gave them that information. I could have moved. You know, they're 6 years old. What do they know? But in my little selfish, self-centered being, they all knew I wasn't good enough or smart enough. Those things don't make me alcoholic, but they were the fertile ground for my spiritual malady. If that my spiritual malady was a seed, that was fertile soil to plant it in. And so immediately, when I found alcohol at the ripe age of 12, I used as much as I could, as often as I could. I remember early on in my drinking career, my parents, you know, they didn't, I've never seen my father drunk. I've seen my mother intoxicated a handful of times in my life. But they had a bottle of dry gin in the pantry for their friends when they would come over. And I remember as a 12-year-old kid, I'm up late at night playing Super Nintendo, right? And I'm waiting for my parents to go to bed. And the moment I'm peeking out in the hallway and I'm waiting for everybody to go to sleep, and the moment I can assure myself that everyone's asleep, I'm pouring myself bottles of gin at 12 years old. I mean, I don't know if normal kids drank dry gin alone at 12 years old, because I'm not a normal kid. I got in trouble everywhere. My mother told a story recently about she went to a parent support group when I was in, you know, active drug and alcohol addiction as an adolescent. She went there. It was a lot like Al-Anon, but it was a privately held group for parents with troubled kids. And my mom walks in devastated. She's got this drug addict, alcoholic adolescent son who's a terrorist in his neighborhood. And the lady sharing talks about how if her son could be kept away from that kid, Brad, everything would be okay. Can you imagine my mother in that meeting? Just, God, should I tell her that's my son? See, I like to do bad things. Even before I like to drink alcohol, I mean, I would get in trouble from as early as I can remember. I mean, I'm the guy who, you know, at every gas station, there's this red button outside. It says emergency shutoff switch. That guy's the guy, too. He knows exactly where this story's going. I'm the guy who's just walked up to that switch and hit it just to see what would happen. If you're wondering, in case of a fire, that switch is to turn off the gas pump so that the fire would stop from spreading. But I'm a guy who would just hit that button to see what would happen. See, my alcoholism progressed quickly. I don't ever remember drinking as a social drinker. I liked the effect it produced in me. I liked getting loaded. I've never once drank for a social cause. I remember when we were young in my neighborhood, you know, right around 7:30, people would be coming home from work. So I would walk around my neighborhood. I'd wait for people to leave their garage doors open, and I'd go in their garages and I would just take stuff. Right? And I wasn't pawning them for crack or anything like that. I just, like I said, I like to do bad things. And I'd steal golf clubs and BMX bikes and really anything you have. And what I would do is I would just take them and throw them in a lake. Seemed like an adequate thing to do with them. So there's a lake somewhere in Orlando, Florida, just packed full of just BMX bikes and golf clubs and... But you know what the prized possession was? It wasn't a $1,000 set of golf clubs. It wasn't a $500 BMX bike. It was a 12-pack of Budweiser, warm, sitting in your garage. You would have thought I won the lottery. I remember one time my friend Ryan and I'm running out with cheese, smiling, ear to ear, you know, like, look what I got. 12-pack of Budweiser. Ryan takes one sip of one warm Budweiser and says, no, thank you. I've never been so excited in my whole life. You're telling me 11 for me? Perfect. Because I like the effect produced by alcohol. I don't like the taste of alcohol. I know some of you do. Some of you are connoisseurs of wines and brandies and scotches. And I'll drink Mad Dog 2020, and I'll drink wine from a box. I'll drink the cheapest stuff they have. The plastic bottle is what I'm looking for, because I have no, you know, taste. I'm so young at this time that my senses haven't even, you know, advanced to the stage where I can tell the difference between a $3 bottle of liquor and a $30 bottle of liquor. But I know that $3 bottle of liquor will get me where I want to get quick. See, alcoholism was really a significant part of my mother's life. I didn't know this when I was a kid, but she grew up in an alcoholic home. She had an alcoholic father. She had alcoholic brothers and uncles, and she watched alcoholism devastate her family. And I have a black belt codependent mother. I mean, Al-Anon from birth kind of mother, you know. And I remember at 15 years old them telling me that I was an alcoholic. They knew. You know, they had been trying to find out what was wrong with me since I was 6 years old. I seen a psychiatrist for the first time at 6 years old. They've always been looking for what's wrong with Brad. And then my grandmother and my mother come to find out that Brad was an alcoholic. I made it to the rooms for the first time at 15 years old. And I qualified for a member of Alcoholics Anonymous at 15 years old. I had a mental obsession and a physical allergy. I didn't know it yet. I just walked in the room and I saw you people, and all you people were not like me. And I used every excuse to alienate myself from you. Whether you didn't have my skin color, you weren't my age, you weren't my gender, whatever it was, you were different from me. And I heard your stories and I compared every little piece that you had. I didn't try to, you know, look to see where we had some similarities or, you know, some common strands and how we drank and used and the emotional nature and the way in which alcoholism affected me. None of that stuff. I just walked in at 15 years old, found a girl. There was this girl. She was 16. Was at the Yana group in Orlando. She was 16, and she had a driver's license. So I fell in love quickly. And I stayed sober for a little bit, a couple of days. I even got a sponsor by name. His name was Nick. I don't know anything else about the guy. I just know that I went to this meeting. They asked me if I had a sponsor. I once asked a guy named Nick to be my sponsor. I never called him once, still have never called him once, and never talked about any of my grosser handicaps, how to recreate my life, how to build a relationship with God. But the next time you asked me if I had a sponsor, I could say, yeah, Nick's my sponsor. I actually had a sponsor. The girl was probably my sponsor. Yeah, it's so funny. I remember I was maybe 60 days sober. I'd really gone to meetings and, you know, I wasn't working on a program. I was just holding on. I was on probation at this time. And I had been arrested for those, you know, extracurricular activity I was doing in those garages. I got caught and I got arrested and put on probation. And I stayed sober for roughly 60. I mean, I'm getting drug tested every 3 weeks at this time. And, you know, they're really on me. I'm seeing an outpatient therapist. And I remember this girl one night told me we had to break up. And I was like, why do we have to break up? She's like, I started drinking again. And she couldn't even get the words out of her mouth fast enough before I was willing to pick up a drink. You know what I'm saying? Because I had no power. I had no defense against the first drink. Right? I had put all my power in her. And the moment she said she was out, I was out for the races. You know, for the next few months, I went out as hard as I could with this girl in these situations, and I started to go down a path in which I had sworn I would never go down. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous has saved my life, and alcohol is a significant part of my message, but I used bottom accelerators, if you know what I mean. You know, as a 17-year-old kid, it's hard, you know, they ID you to get alcohol. They don't ID you to buy drugs. I'm just going to put it out there. You know what I mean? Like, the dope man wasn't going, how old are you, sir? You know? So, I have never said no to any mood or mind-altering substance in my whole life. Some of you guys are special. I'm not a guy that uses A, B, and C, but not D, E, and F. I'll use everything that you put in front of me every time. You tell me it's going to make me feel different, I'm in. Just the kind of guy I am. Some of them I liked more than others. But I had to get rid of that internal discomfort. See, I have had that. I had that my whole life. I wasn't good enough. I wasn't smart enough. And so as I went out after another, you know, attempt at Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went out, you know, my mother and my probation officer and, you know, at that time my therapist thought it'd be a good time for Brad to go away to like a long-term treatment center. You know, there are a lot of treatment centers come into rooms at AA, and I talk to a lot of guys who are in treatment. They're like, I can't believe it. I'm in treatment for 90 days. I get a resentment. I was in treatment for 13 months, October 26, 1999 to November 24th of 2000. Every single day I was in treatment. See, while I was in treatment, I used as much as I could. You know, when I was in treatment, I started to find that as much as I wanted to stop, I couldn't stop. See, I had continuously, and I tell the story, you know, they took my shoes away. I was in a therapeutic community. They've shut most of these places down for, like, physically abusing kids. So, you know, this is back in the 90s when some of this stuff was still cool. But they'd, like, take your shoes and your socks and your belt, and, you know, they were like, we're going to break you down to build you up. And I would escape from that facility as many times as I could to go feel an effect produced by drugs and alcohol. These were sad, desperate times in my life. Every time I'd be running from that facility, that mental obsession would take over. I wouldn't think of shoeless Brad drinking, you know, NyQuil by the bottle or, you know, stealing Mad Dog 2020 from the gas station. I wouldn't think of that Brad. I'd think of Caribbean Brad. You know, that one time I went down to the Caribbean, had a great time with my friends and didn't have any trouble on the horizon. I would think of that Brad. I wouldn't think of shoeless, respectless, fearful, angry, resentful Brad. I wouldn't think of that Brad. I'd be like, it's going to be different this time. It's going to be like Caribbean Brad down in Jamaica. You know, and it kept getting worse. Every time I'd go out on another one of these runs, you know, it would get worse. So on March 30th of 2000, or March 31st of 2000, I left that facility, and I went out and I found myself, and I wish you guys could see it. I'm a young guy with an afro, and I'm stealing clothes, and I don't have shoes on, and I'm out on a run, and I'm walking into an Eckerd's drugstore. And I'm not even at this time, like, my life's so unmanageable. I'm not even, like, stealing stuff and leaving the store. I am drinking NyQuil in the store. I mean, have you ever seen the alcohol content of this stuff? It's unreal, you know. Robitussin, DM, NyQuil. I mean, I'm just going to town in the store. I'm grabbing, you know, Ready Whip containers. And for all you drug addicts, you know, I'm out of my mind, you know. I have a moment of clarity during this whole episode. Just a moment, right? I'm going to fast forward here. As a man with a real message, I think it's so important that I'm attentive to the newcomer, because I really think they only get moments of clarity, and those moments will leave them if a message Alcoholics Anonymous isn't put in front of them, right? I wasn't guaranteed that this moment was going to keep me sober for anything, right? Bill talks about a moment of clarity on page 8 in the big book where he says, no words can tell of the loneliness and despair I felt in the bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I'd become overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. That's a moment of clarity. That's the kind of moment of clarity I had April 1st of 2000. Bill drinks in the next line. Trembling I set from the hospital a broken man. Fear would sober me for a bit, but then came the insidious insanity, the first drink. I think it's so vital that as a man with a real answer, I am attentive to the guy who's coming in, who's got a moment of clarity. Because like Bill, that moment, I believe, would have been short-lived. My sobriety date is April 1st of 2000. I don't really know what happened. I know that God had a major part of this deal, that because I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous to get and stay sober for good and for all. I had no intention. The police picked me up that night and said, hey, you look like a runaway. I had no other defense. I was like, you're right, I'm a runaway. They They bring me back to my drug and alcohol treatment center, and I am just exhausted with this lifestyle. And I say, I'll try this AA thing out. See, there was this girl who used to bring this meeting in. I'm just telling you the truth. Her name was Kim, and she's a pretty girl, young girl. She brought a meeting into my treatment center out of a meeting in West Palm Beach called Love, Faith, and Life. And I remember it was a Monday night, and I had walked up to her. I said, Kim, is there young people in the rooms Alcoholics Anonymous? I've only seen older folks in the rooms Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't relate. I thought I was so special. I need young people like you, Kim, to help me get sober. Kim was like, sure, when you can, come to Love, Faith, and Life. God intervened in my life. My first meeting I got out, I went to a men's meeting Sunday night. And I walked up to this meeting, and there was a guy at the door. His name was Brian, and he was wearing scrubs. He was a nurse, and he welcomed me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I hadn't felt welcome anywhere in a long time. Brian sat at that door. He said, Brad, nice to meet you. Do you have a home group and a sponsor? See, this is my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous, maybe not your introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. I hear a lot of times in the rooms, like, you know, go to a meeting and look for a sponsor who has what you want. I didn't know what I wanted. I truly would have wanted a guy with a wife and a girlfriend who smoked weed recreationally. I mean, that's probably what I wanted. So, I mean, my picker was way off. For the first time in my life, I just feel defeated, and I tell Brian, no, I don't. And yeah, I didn't even know what a sponsor was. I thought I would have correlated sponsorship to like NASCAR. I would wear your patch. You would pay for my halfway house. And at 1 year sober, I would give you credit from the microphone. So I would have picked Bob. I had no idea. No idea. So I said no. And they didn't go, okay, look for someone who has what you want. Brian walked me to the front of the room of this meeting. He put my name in the book. And this is before cell phones. He gave me a list of the handout, all the men with their home phone numbers. He said, here you go. And then he brought four guys up to me, Adam, Tony, Dino, and Bernie. If I was to pick, I would have picked Tony. He was a real cool guy. He drove a Cadillac, and he had a lot of swagger. Or Dino. Dino had been in prison for a long time. He used to bite the filters off the cigarettes and smoke them with no filters. I thought Dino was the coolest. He said, Bernie will be your sponsor. Bernie was a 67-year-old Polish guy from New Jersey. He was a pure alcoholic. He had 27 years of sobriety. We had absolutely nothing in common, me and Bernie. I mean, here I am. I'm a 17-year-old, you know, crack-smoking, just wild man with an afro and a Wu-Tang shirt. And I don't even know what me and Bernie could have in common. Man, this group was different, man. Everybody in this group had one of these books at him. Everybody. You couldn't find a man in that meeting not carrying his book with him. I'm telling you, you would start sharing some wild left-to-center stuff, and one of the guys in the group might have grabbed his book and just smacked you right across the top of your head and said, Brad, where in the book does it say that? Some people call them like big book Nazis or thumpers or something. I mean, they were that kind of guy. Bernie did something different that I had never seen it done before. He qualified me as an alcoholic. He asked me questions about my drinking career. He asked me about choice and control. He asked me if I ever wanted to stop drinking and drank against my own will. I had never heard that. I had no idea what being an alcoholic was. I just thought I drank too much, and that made me alcoholic. He told me it had nothing to do with how much I drank or how old I was or where I was or what I did. It had to do with my inability to choose whether I picked it up or not. And that once I put it in my body, I would lose control of my consumption once I started to drink. See, I had no idea how truly in trouble I was. I can remember knowing I needed to stop. I can remember knowing that I was going to be getting a drug test because I was on probation. You would think, with those consequences at hand, I would be able to control or moderate what I was putting in my body. But unfortunately, once I began to use, I lost all ability to pick and choose what I was and wasn't going to do that night. I might have wanted to drink two or three. You know, four or five, those are good numbers for me. I just seemed to miss the mark. I'd get to 10, 11, and 12, not the steps, the dream. And one of you big guys would beat me up again. I didn't know how to keep my mouth shut. I needed desperately what Bernie had to offer me. See, he knew that in the book, it told him, like, when you find a man, right? When you discover a man, a prospect for Alcoholics Anonymous, they told him what to do, and that's exactly what he did with me. I was a prospect. God, we're so lucky today in my home group. You know, you could just walk outside to the parking lot, and they pull prospects up in big white vans. The solution to my problem gets just delivered to me in a van. Some of them have signage on the side, like, newcomer here, you know. X, Y, and Z treatment center. Those are the guys I need. See, these guys were just looking. They were looking for a guy to help. So really quickly, they got me involved in the 12 Steps Alcoholics Anonymous once they qualified me as alcoholic. Like, quick and in a hurry. You know, I finished the 12 Steps Alcoholics Anonymous by 4 months sober. They talked to me about, you know, how Bill had this white light spiritual experience in Towns Hospital at 9 days sober, and he had worked the steps with Ebbie Thatcher while in the hospital. Can you imagine going to a detox center tomorrow and some guy with 9 days sober just says, I had a spiritual experience last night and I know the solution to my problem. I'm just going to carry this message to the next guy. I mean, we'd Baker Act that guy. That's how our program started, you know. You know, they taught me about the history of this whole deal and how special it was and how cool it was to be a part of. And I started to buy into it all. They talked to me about Carl Jung and his meeting with Roland Hazard and how significant that had to be and how that, you know, that Carl Jung and Roland Hazard could have seen anybody. He could have seen Sigmund and Freud, and those guys don't believe in God, but he went and saw Carl Jung, and that guy believed in God. And he told him that his problem was beyond human aid, and he needed a God to help him. And how that guy sponsored a guy named Ebbie Thatcher. He told him the same deal, and Bill happened to be in the hospital with a guy, Silkworth, and that guy told him that, you know, he had a physical allergy, and then boom, AA started. How could that not be divinely inspired by God? You know, I started believing. I started, this thing started to take shape for me. If those of you who were in here last night or yesterday when I did 4 and 5, you'll hear the same story. Because at 4 months sober, I was so jazzed about this AA thing. You know, at that time, Bernie was like, Brad, time for you to start sponsoring guys. He called them pigeons. Some of you might find it offensive. It's just what they called me, and he told me to go find a pigeon. And I was like, Bernie, I'm 4 months sober. No one wants what I have. He goes, find someone desperate enough. So I found Jared. You know, God, Jared. See, my grandfather, I had got my grandfather's second edition big book. You know, my parents gave it to me, a big book that he had had when he was sober, and I had it, and it was my little book, and it was second edition, and this was third edition times, so I was extra cool in the meetings because mine was second edition. And I remember I went and saw Jared in the meeting. He was brand new. You know, he raised his hand, got a white chip. I went to him after the meeting. I said, Jared, do you have a sponsor? He said, no. I said, I will be your sponsor. Do you have a big book, Jared? He said, no, sir. I said, you can have mine. Tonight you will read the doctor's opinion out of the book, and we will meet tomorrow. I've never seen Jared since. Or that book. God bless. I hope Jared's sober, right? I remember he made an inventory. I'm writing it down. My sponsor's like, well, maybe that book will help him one day. I'm like, but it's my book. Now we got fourth editions. I'd look extra cool with a second edition, you know? Man, what a cool place AA is. What a remarkable design for living for a guy like me that was going nowhere in life. And I'm a guy who should have been in prison or something like that. I mean, we did the kind of drinking and drugging I did, you know. We commit crimes, you know, like heinous crimes with handguns. And so, you know, we just, you know, and I have to, my life has changed because of a program and a design for living that really works. You know, I had no idea what I was in store for. I had no idea what we were talking about here. I had no idea that I needed to build a relationship with a God to recreate my life. I grew up in the Catholic Church. I thought that would be easy for me. I believed my whole life. Bernie explained to me that I had put so much stuff between me and God that I couldn't even see him anymore. He didn't even exist for me because I had so much blockage between me and him. And that all the belief in the world would not suffice in the certain trials and low spots ahead, that I had to get to the point in which I had action and was working on developing and maintaining the spiritual connection with God. You know, they weren't afraid to talk to me about how important that relationship was going to be for me, and that without it, I was going to drink again. That's what being an alcoholic was. That as much as I wanted to stop, I'd get in a strange mental blank spot. You ever been in those strange mental blank spots? People are like, I don't understand how he drank again. The doctor just told him he would die if he did it again. Strange mental blank spot. It'll be different for me. I'll just do X, Y, and Z. I'll control it better. I'll maintain it. I won't drink at work. I won't drink at home. I'll only drink at home. I won't drink and drive. I'll only drink and drive. I don't know, whatever. Whatever happened in your strange mental blank spots, you know? Mine were always about trying something new, you know? I'd get beat up drinking tequila, so I'd start drinking whiskey. Then I'd get beat up drinking whiskey, so I'd start drinking rum, you know? That story keeps going, you know? I just maybe should have went to the gym more often and stopped getting beat up so much. Those strange mental blank spots. I mean, he would hit that home to me. He told me that was going to be a guarantee of mine. That someday nothing would stand between me and a drink but God. And I better have that relationship on point because he didn't know when that day was going to be. Certain days I'd be in fine spiritual condition and things would be good, but there would be guaranteed times in my life where I would stand at a turning point and it'd be me, the drink, and if God wasn't there, I'd pick it up against my own will. See, the first step experience is sort of scary. It's the guarantee I'm going to drink again against my own will. If left to myself, I will drink liquor again. And he put the truth in front of me that although that is the case for you, we've seen hundreds of thousands of people recover from that hopeless condition. They've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. Man, I wanted to be safe and protected. I didn't have to run from it anymore. I didn't have to hide, and I have to lock myself up. I just had to maintain a certain spiritual attitude. That might not sound too cool for you who are new, maintaining a certain spiritual attitude. But it has become the backbone of my existence, right? It has become the foundation of my life, is trying to maintain that certain spiritual attitude. I am by no means an expert at this, you know. I make mistakes all the time. My tree, if you were here yesterday, right? My selfish, self-centered, dishonest, frightful tree blocks me off from that relationship from God. You know, it does at time to time. I get to the point in which I've done, you know, where my behavior has put me in a position where I've put me first. See, selfish and self-centeredness, that was the root of what was wrong with me. And if I wanted to recreate my life, I had to be selfless. And I couldn't even wish that upon myself. I didn't know how to become that. So I had to do actions that would help me put me in a position where I was being selfless. Right after me and Bernie finished the steps, he told me to get a new sponsor. He said, "Hey, Brad, I think you should benefit. I'm glad you went through the steps. You know, I'm going to pass you off to one of my guys. You're young and crazy, and you need someone a little younger to work with you." You know, and that's been my journey. I got with another guy, and we did the same thing. I remember Andy, my second sponsor. We got right in the book and worked the steps again. The whole time, they impressed upon me how important it was for me to work with the next man. You know, and that if I was going through troubles and if I was having difficulties in my life and in different areas in my life, that the book reminded me that I just needed to throw myself the harder into helping others. That I need to put someone else's livelihood, you know, in front of mine. And that didn't have to just be in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. That could be with my parents or my children or in my community, you know, or at work. That I was suffering from a disease that was selfish and self-centered. It was grounded in that. My recovery has been, you ever just met someone who just like gets, you know, I don't know, lucky all the time? I mean, my life has been pretty blessed, truthfully. Some of my home group members and longtime friends are here. I mean, I got a pretty awesome life. You know, God has opened some doors for me that, you know, I'm already in a place where I never thought I'd be. You know. See, when I got sober, these men that had put themselves in my life and had surrounded me, they told me that if my life sober wasn't impossible while drinking, I was doing it wrong. I remember hearing that. That if my life sober wasn't impossible while drinking, I was doing it wrong. That I should do pretty miraculous things as a sober man. So I'm a high school dropout. I'm a 10th grade high school dropout with a learning disability, right? And these guys were like, hey, Brad, here's a cool idea. Come over here. I think you should go back to school. They're like, sober men do miraculous things, man. They do all sorts of crazy, miraculous things. You should go get an education. And I remember, you know, I enrolled in the Adult Education Center to get my GED early in my recovery, and the whole time I'm driving there, right, this is how my disease works. I'm riddled with fear about how I'm not good enough and I'm not smart enough. And right when I get in the room, I'm like, I'm better than all these people. Selfishness and self-centeredness, that's what you think is the root of the problem. Driven by 100 forms of fear, here I am again. But the men in Alcoholics Anonymous believed in me when I didn't believe in myself. You know, and the women, I had powerful women in my life. I've had powerful men in my life. I've been a part of some really awesome sponsorship families and people who really, really went above and beyond for me. I remember these guys encouraging me the whole time, and I went ahead and I got that GED. I'm a high school dropout. I got that GED, and I was so proud of myself. And he said, you know, now you got to go to college. What are you talking about, college? I'm a high school dropout with a learning disability. I can't do that. I'm not smart enough. I'm not good enough. 7 10 years later, I got an associate's degree. Yep. This talk is not only about education, it's about doing things that are impossible in your life as a sober man. Another knucklehead guy that was sponsoring me said, hey, you should go back to school, get a bachelor's degree. And I'm like, what are you talking about? 2 years and a semester later, I got a bachelor's degree. And some real crazy guys said, oh, you should go get a master's degree. You could do it. You're a smart guy, Brad. And I told them I wasn't good enough. Because I believe that. I got this committee in my head still today that tells me I'm not good enough. Or I'm better than. They only pick two arguments. I am either not good enough or I am better than you. And for me, that committee gets louder and quieter based on how connected I am to God. But it has never gone away. It is still there. I walked around the room tonight before the meeting, and I'm telling you, man, that committee was on. Tell me how I'm not good enough. And the only way I could get it to stop were my brothers and sisters and the people I love came and prayed for me before I came up here and did this talk. That was the only way it subsided. But I sat out there feeling not good enough. I don't know what it is, right? It's been there my whole life. But the moment I get more connected to God, that voice quiets. And in 2 years, I got a master's degree from a university, you know? And if one of you is willing to pay for a doctorate, I'll do it. See, it was important for me to realize and encourage the men around me that this was a design for living that could recreate your life. How a high school dropout with a learning disability that wasn't good enough and smart enough and really believed those things to the core of who he was could run a company with 148 employees and have a master's degree and, you know, have all this pretty miraculous stuff in his life. You know why? Because he worked the steps. Because he started to let God do things within his life that were impossible for him to do. See, the things in my life were impossible for me to do. Because left to my own devices, I drink again against my own will. And I cause chaos in my life, drunk or sober. I mean, some of the biggest chaos I've caused in my life have been sober. That's the stuff you don't have an excuse for. I was at dinner yesterday with a guy, and he was talking about some behavior that's questionable, and he's like, but I was drinking. In my head, I was like, done that sober. Just saying. I didn't say that at dinner. But that's what went on in my head. Now, he had an excuse. I'm like, I don't got nothing. So important for me to know I didn't have to be perfect. You don't have to be perfect. Just continuously try to reconnect. Yesterday I heard the talk on step 6 and 7. Man, 6 and 7, powerful stuff. Separate men from the boys, the women from the girls. The continual effort to try to work on these character defects in and of itself is a spiritual experience. Waking up every day trying to work on these defects of character has become a spiritual experience in my life. Sometimes, you know, my daily disciplines, I do that 11th step inventory at night, and some days, pretty good. Some days, pretty bad. That continual effort has been a spiritual experience. I've gotten to the point where, you know, I've been married to the same woman for almost 14 years. Yeah. I have 2 kids. I have a 7-year-old, Alexis, my daughter. Man, I love her to death. And I got a 4-year-old Jackson. Man, he's a pain. Something's wrong with him. I don't know what it is, but beginning to worry. I'm like, Jackson, put that down. He's like, Jackson, look me right in the eyes. Where'd you learn that? Probably me. I got this beautiful relationship with my mother, father, and my sister, and my family, and they've become such a valuable part of my life. These are people I was willing to sacrifice time with. They didn't mean that much to me when I was drinking and using drugs. I put them at the bottom of the list. I remember once my grandfather was sick. He had cancer. And my mother and father, they sat me down. They sat all the kids down. They said, this might be the last time you see him. He has cancer. He lived in New York. You know, we live down here. And I got a couple dollars and I went out, went and got loaded. Didn't spend the time with my grandfather. See, it wasn't as I was in a bad person. See, I had no choice in the matter. The moment I caught a couple dollars in my pocket, that voice started to talk to me, tell me it was going to be different, it was going to be okay, they wouldn't miss you, you'll see grandfather again, everything will be fine. And I went out and got loaded against my own will. I've had a deep and effective spiritual experience as a result of working the steps. And I've had the educational variety they talk about in Appendix 2, and I've had that burning bush white light experience as well. And that didn't come until I had 13 or 14 years sober. I know that to achieve long-term permanent recovery, I got to have a psychic change, a spiritual awakening, right? And although I might be able to walk into a church and get it, and I believe people, you know, have been saved and walked in all sorts of denominations of churches, and this stuff has been lifted from them. I believe that. We don't have any monopoly on God. We just have a direction manual. And I needed directions. I was lost. I needed directions. It's so important for me as a man with a real answer to always be concerned with that guy walking in the room. God, I hope if you're here today, you come up and give me a chance to talk to you, and hopefully I can impart upon you how miraculous this journey has been for a guy like me. I'm sure there's hundreds of people in the room who could also speak the same talk. How miraculous this journey has been for them. Man, I don't deserve this life. I don't. But as a result of working the steps, good sponsorship, sponsoring others, you know, carrying the message, having a home group, being in the center of AA, all sorts of miraculous things have happened. It's been such an honor and privilege to speak with you guys here today. Hope you have a great day. That's it.
For those who would like to join